You're listening to Native Digital, Native Analog, the show where I, a Gen Zer, dissect collisions and commonalities between my generation and yours. Why does this matter? There are now more native digitals than native analogs, and it's the native digitals who are rewriting every way we work, think, and play. I can't stand by and watch native analog leaders, businesses, and parents teeter on the precipice of irrelevance while native digitals push them off the cliff. I believe that if you don't have a native digital on your board of directors, your leadership team, or one that's paid to pester you like a fly in your ear, you won't survive. Let's change that today. Hi friends, welcome to my den. When you hear the word luxury, what types of words come to mind? For me, as a native digital, some of the first things that come to mind are snobbery, billionaires, things are too expensive. It's often associated for me as someone who grew up in a middle-class family as a word that connotes snobbery. And someone who's unwilling or who looks down upon other people. But my guest today is someone who has changed the definition of luxury and luxury business for me as a native digital. Her name is Elizabeth Solaru, and she is just an incredible person in general, but her story is fascinating. She is someone who now, if you look at her present life, is an international keynote speaker. She's the author of the best-selling book, Opulencia. But most of her life, she has spent creating and baking and decorating wedding cakes for some of the most celebrated celebrities and international stars in existence. In fact, on today's podcast, you're going to hear her tell the story of how she started in the cake business by baking for someone who is a very close relative of Queen Elizabeth. That is a fascinating story that she is going to share today. Now, here's the thing about Elizabeth that I absolutely adore. She has spent her time in all sorts of different industries before coming into the luxury world of business. But something that's unique about her is even though she is a native analog and someone who did not grow up integrated with machines as the native digitals did, she is still finding ways to connect with the next generation in incredibly meaningful and intentional ways. And she and I connected in a kind of interesting way, which you'll get to hear on this episode as well. But what I love about our conversation today is you're going to hear her stories from her childhood that she even told me after we recorded this session she hasn't thought about for years. The story of really what influenced her to get into the business of cake making and what has continued to influence her as she has launched her business, the Luxury Business Emporium, where she is helping clients in the luxury business to stay relevant to the next generation and to build better luxury businesses. I know you are going to love this conversation. It is a special dialogue with someone who is near and dear to me. You are going to hear about everything from her story into how she made NFT history this year. You're also going to hear about her podcast. And if you have not checked out her podcast, it is absolutely worth listening to. It's called Luxury News Weekly, and she and her friend or colleague, Simba Wakatama, they talk about luxury business and what it holds for us now and in the future, and which luxury businesses are changing to adapt to the times and to native digitals. I highly recommend that you check it out. We are about to dive deep into this conversation, and I am excited to have you along for the ride here in my living room. Before we dive in, I want to remind you that this show is brought to you by Overture Consulting. If you're a leader or a business owner in a mid-sized company and you want to improve the retention of employees under age 30, be sure to sign up for our free masterclass held on the second and fourth Thursdays of every month, where we give you tactical strategies to make you a top native digital employer. You can register for that at hannahgwilliams.com/get-that-shit. And now, hang on to your seats or time machines if you're cool like that, and join me in my living room with the amazing Elizabeth Solaro, who is my guest today. Hi, Elizabeth. Welcome to my living room.
Hi, Hannah. Thank you so much for having me on your show. I'm so happy to be here.
I'm just happy that we're no longer on Clubhouse, that we're getting to do this more formally now.
I know, right? Who would have thought it? When we met on Clubhouse many, many months ago during lockdown, who would have thought that you'd end up having this wonderful podcast and you'd have written that incredible, incredible book? Congratulations.
Oh, I appreciate that. And I can't even remember. Was it back in January? I feel like it's almost been a year ago since we were in that Clubhouse room where we met.
Yes, probably January, February. You're absolutely correct. Oh my goodness. It has been a year. Oh
and
dear.
Funny story, jumping into that Clubhouse room, I remember seeing some sort of title like, what was it? Something like, you know, grow your business or whatever. And I jumped in. I think I was the only person from this side of the pond in that whole room. I think it was mostly business owners and experts over on your side of the pond. So that was an experience for me.
Oh, wow. I didn't think that, though, at the time. I think in those days, Clubhouse was fairly new. And everybody just was sharing. I remember people were sharing so much deep, real knowledge. And unfortunately, I think what happened was over time, that kind of got lost. I think there's something about the authenticity and the honesty that people initially brought to Clubhouse that kind of got lost when people are trying to get followers. But in those days, it was actually a really, really good experience.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. Are you still holding sessions on Clubhouse at all?
Rarely. To be honest, what I do now, I support one or two other rooms. Mm-hmm. I used to do a number of luxury rooms. I used to do about 3-4 times a week. I would do luxury rooms. So rooms on luxury branding, luxury marketing, luxury selling, buying. I used to talk about the psychology of luxury buyers, the different types of luxury buyers. But I think I kind of stopped that because, again, the UK opened up after mm-hmm. lockdown. And right. Once the UK opened up, it was back to work. But I think because of the direction that I'm going in now, I might go back to Clubhouse maybe once or twice a week.
That makes complete sense. And I've actually been hearing that from several people who used to be very active on the platform. They were just saying, you know, it used to be great and authentic. And, you know, when it first started, we had these smaller rooms that had great discussion. But as the platform lost, you know, some active people who'd been on there, it just seemed to kind of fizzle out. I mean, what do you even think went wrong?
I think, like everything else, I think people tend to forget a couple of things. One, Clubhouse was in its infancy, so it was a new audio app, and people joined out of excitement. Secondly, I think the expectations were extremely high, mm-hmm. but from what I understand, the back-end staff wasn't that many. And they had masses and masses of problems with their servers, which thankfully they seem to have rectified for the most part. And the third thing was that they didn't think through the inability to record, because many people right. wanted to be able to record. I think they have a playback mechanism now. They've certainly added a number of features to the app. Fantastic features. So I think the experience is a little bit better now. But in the early days, a number of those issues with the fact that people, once the novelty wore off, people were off to another app. Mm-hmm. I think Discord came out as well. And some people went off to Discord. So yes, it was just the early adopter phase of things where people join out of excitement and then it fizzles out and then it comes back again.
No, I completely think that could have happened. And I was actually, one of my good friends, Christopher Lockhead, had the founders of Hallo App and also WhatsApp. They were, you know, the same guys did the two. They came onto his podcast a few months ago and they were talking about Clubhouse and why, you know, Clubhouse seems to have fizzled out versus something like WhatsApp, where many people around the world use WhatsApp on a daily basis for all sorts of things.
That's correct.
And it was kind of interesting. They were talking about it. It was Michael Donahue and I can't even pronounce his name, Niraj Arora, I believe. And they were talking about how when they designed WhatsApp, it was so crucial for them that the back end of the platform was the part that functioned well versus the user interface. And they were talking about how Clubhouse did the opposite, right? They got a ton of PR and celebrities to endorse it first thing, and then they didn't spend as much time figuring out those back end pieces of why would a user stay on the app, or, you know, the recording side, like you mentioned. You know, why would people keep coming back and using it? And so it just sort of fizzled. So here we are.
But I wouldn't count them out yet. I think there is something there. I think they have realized that they do need to do something about the back end, and people will go back. I think, again, you have your early adopters. You have the most of the early adopters will leave. And then there'll be a new influx of people. But I think there are people that left that I've actually seen coming back. And like I said, I might go back myself to support a couple of other rooms. And I think if they enable the recording function and people can use it as a kind of platform to maybe do a podcast, I think they could be onto a winner.
Oh, well, thank you for that perspective. I'll have to revisit it again because, you know, it's definitely been several months since I've been there, but meeting people like you, and I don't know if you are still in touch with Gavin Preston. He and I connected there, and I actually had probably the funniest story from Clubhouse. I went into one of those giant rooms back at the very beginning. It probably had 1,000 or 1,500 people in it, and I went up on stage and probably waited, you know, an hour or more to get up there to ask a question. But I didn't realize that Manny Fernandez was in the room. And I asked a question. He ended up being the one responding. So I can say now I've had a conversation with Manny Fernandez. You know, I've talked to a shark from Shark Tank. So, you know, it's there was a positive there for sure of being on Clubhouse, even if it was for a 3-minute conversation.
Oh, wow. Oh, my goodness. That's huge. Well done.
It is. There's some interesting people on there for sure. But I feel like meeting people like you is the best thing that happened on the platform. And speaking of that, I feel like after all the times that we've spoken and just, you know, gotten to know each other through you being so kind to interview for my book, I really haven't heard much about your actual story of getting to where you are now. And so I really, really, truly would love to learn more about that. So can you just like start me at the beginning? Like what's something, let's say, from your childhood, what's something that you just, you know, you haven't had a chance to talk about with all of us because, you know, we're so busy being adults and running our businesses. And, you know, here I am, I'm, you know, 23 and I'm still at the very beginning. And you've had many years of experience in all sorts of different areas and facets of life. So take me back to the beginning. Like, what's something about you that the world doesn't really know about you?
Gosh, thank you. Well, if I look back into my childhood, one of the things that stand out for me was the fact that I had to go to boarding school. And I was the only one of my siblings to go to boarding school. So I didn't have a great time at boarding school, let's put it that way. I really do not want to relive some of the things I went through, but it was quite traumatic because what had happened was I was born in the UK, in London, and went to part of my primary school, certainly in the UK. And then my parents decided to take us back to Nigeria in Africa. And we arrived, and that was a culture shock. I mean, I can tell you this, my tongue was on fire because the food was so spicy. And
it sounds delicious, though.
Well, but it was honestly, I believe some of my taste buds must have been burnt off because it was so spicy. But the one thing I do remember, I remember the warmth. People were very, very warm. I remember the neighborliness. It wasn't unusual for one woman to feed random kids. Literally just, you know, kids could go into anyone's house and you can eat. And it was just so lovely. I absolutely adored the school that I went to. They had, I mean, people complain about school dinners. Our school dinners were absolutely delicious, really delicious, not that spicy. So going to boarding school was a bit of a shock.
So just to clarify, so your boarding school was in Nigeria?
It was in Nigeria, and it was a shock. It was a shock. It was not the kind. To give an example, you had to go and get water. So you didn't have water coming out of, well, water came out of taps, but you to have a shower, you had to get your bucket and you had to go get your water every day. And you had to cut the grass. There were no lawn mowers. You had cutlasses. I don't know if anyone knows what a cutlass, you know.
I have no idea.
Right. A cutlass is like a big, the most giantest knife you can ever imagine. Is like a machete.
Very interesting. So you
literally had to use that to cut the grass.
And you as kids at the school, I'm assuming,
absolutely.
You were the ones doing it.
Oh, absolutely. It was like a self-sufficient kind of school. So we had a farm, we had cows and pigs and sheep, and then we grew our own vegetables. So each child had a plot. You had your little plot to grow your own vegetables. So you didn't grow veg, you didn't eat, kind of thing. It wasn't as drastic as that, but it was, it kind of like taught you to be self-sufficient. And oh my goodness, I hadn't thought about this in years. And yeah, that was wow. That was a bit of a shock. I remember having blisters on my hands. But after the first month or so, the blisters turned into calluses. So your skin on your hands became very hard anyway. So you kind of get used to it.
So why Nigeria? Why was that school the one your parents chose?
Because it was near my grad. It was near my grandmother, and my grandmother was near to keep an eye on me. So, and I love my grandmother. I mean, my grandmother was like the best thing in the world to me. She was amazing. Incredible woman, love her. I think she's probably a feminist before her time because she was into timber, you know, like timber. Mm-hmm. So she was she'd literally go into the forest and select the kind of timber that she wanted. And she was the kind of woman that, and you know, again, not being too dramatic, she would literally kill a snake. So if you go into the forest, obviously there are snakes everywhere. All the men will run away and she would literally kill the snakes. That was my grandma.
That's phenomenal.
I know, right?
and to be near her, like how long were you at the boarding school?
Oh, just 1 year.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I didn't survive that long.
too many calluses?
Oh my God. Are you joking? Are you kidding me? I lost so much weight. I did not cope very well. I did not cope very well.
What are some of the things you think you just stand out from that time period that you learned the most that have influenced who you are now?
Books. I absolutely read. That was the one thing I loved about it. You could read any book. So there were loads of books, as in lots and lots of books to read. I discovered I'd always loved reading anyway, but then it was just so lovely to have access to these amazing books by lots and lots of African authors, especially literature, so many books available to read. So I loved that. I loved having lots of kids in my class, you know, other kids to play mm-hmm. with in the same dormitory, getting up to mischief at midnight, you know, midnight feasts and that sort of thing. So that was a good thing. It was just nice to have. And then I remember we used to have these inter-sports days where another boarding school will come to our school and we'll have a massive sports day. So there was that friendly rivalry. So that was really, really amazing. And then I remember the school used to organize plays and theater, and they'll bring in these incredible performers to come and perform for us. So that was absolutely incredible. So lots and lots of beautiful memories from that time.
The pieces are all coming together now. I know why we're such good friends, why we hit it off. I mean, I'm also an avid reader and I love theater.
Oh, so wow.
Completely makes sense. Fine, it's coming together. So I don't know that I've read much by African authors, though. I mean, I consumed so many classics from England, you know, from the UK when I was younger and still do. I mean, some of my favorite books ever are Dickens. So
absolutely, yeah, favorite of mine, absolutely.
Funny story, Elizabeth, I didn't think this would happen to me in a million years, but just last year, I was at a conference in, where was this? In Florida. And it was, you know, attended by people from Canada and the US, and there were some from other countries internationally. But there was a guy I got to speaking with, and he told me mid-conversation that he is the nephew of Charles Dickens, like the grandnephew.
Oh my God.
And I was wondering, because I asked him about his last name. He was, you know, John Dickens or something like that. And he kind of brushed it off and just said, oh, I just visited Charles Dickens' house like a couple weeks ago, and I've never read any of his books. And I'm just going, oh, you know, you're the grandnephew of Charles Dickens and you've never read his books. You're missing out on an entire world here. So anyway, I was very disappointed when I found out that he had, you know, no reverence for the work of his what would you even call that, great grand uncle? Something like that. But that was a very interesting experience. But what are some of your favorite authors? Like, who should I be reading?
If you want to get started on African authors, I think Chinua Achebe, so Chinua Achebe, Chinua Achebe. Again, Google him. Start with Things Fall Apart. It will take you through the kind of pre-colonial, stroke colonial era, struggles of a man, etc., etc. The protagonist, how he came from really, really humble beginnings, rose to greatness, and then fell again. So,
wow.
So amazing story that. And then there's another lady, Chimamanda. Again, Google her. I can send you links to her. She's written a few books that are quite great. A couple of others as well that I'm happy to DM you. But those are the two that stand out to me in terms of...
I'll definitely look them up.
Yeah, in terms of learnings. I mean, I go back to these books again and again and again. There's another guy that I love. He's Scottish. He's actually, I believe he is a medical lawyer. And he is an amazing writer. And he writes these Lady Detective series. And it's about a fictional African lady who became a detective. It's the number one ladies detective agency book series. And it's, you know, they're just novels, lightweight, lighthearted, but really, really deep. The name of the author is Alexander McCall Smith. Again, I'm happy to send you the link. And I just think his thinking, his writing, very, very good indeed.
Very interesting. And you said it's a series, so it's a series.
Yeah, it's a series. So you can start from the very, very beginning and kind of like read it through. And luckily, each book can stand alone by itself, But it's good to start from the beginning because the main character, Ma Ramotswe, Precious Ramotswe, you can see her getting married, adopting a couple of kids, and then all these adventures, her trying to solve these mysteries, as it were, and setting up her detective agency in Africa.
I love that. And it sounds so non-cliche, you know, the opportunity for a male to write about a female detective, or, have a lady detective series. And then to, you know, if it's an African woman, you said, or did they just have a lot of the adventures in Africa?
It's an African woman. And,
wow.
Again, I think that was what was fascinating for me, because I'm kind of thinking, oh, you know, this is unusual. You know, a man writing about a woman, and it's a white man writing about a black woman. But I can promise you the thinking, it's very African. And
wow.
It's very wise, you know, there's lots of wisdom in it. There's lots of metaphors in it, which I absolutely love. The characterizations, excellent. And I think the first book came out in 1998. And he's written about 22 books so far.
That is amazing. I will absolutely check that out. I love well-done mystery and detective series. I mean, of course, there's only a few that really stand out, but over the years, I feel like even some modern writers are getting much better about writing things that have never existed before versus, you know, just copying Sherlock Holmes. They're actually getting creative. So it sounds like he did that, which is amazing.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. But yeah, I just love, I love his books. I love his writing. I also love, there's an American guy. He writes about Jeffrey Deaver, I think.
Jeffrey Deaver. His name rings a bell.
Jeffrey Deaver. He's an American crime writer. And he was writing about technology and things that you can do remotely way before technology became what it was today. He is incredible. Love his books. Love his, you know, I love his thinking. The detail in his books, amazing. Because I used to be a microbiologist, and I think there was one particular book he wrote, and the research that went into that, he did not get a single thing wrong when it came to the microbiology aspect of it. And that made me respect him, because many people, many films, many books, they always get the science wrong. But
amen, sister.
Exactly. High five. I'm high-fiving you from the UK. And he is incredible. I think he was a lawyer. He has a background in journalism. He was a lawyer. Incredible. Love his work. Absolutely.
I mean, I'm not even a microbiologist or haven't been a scientist in my past, and I can still tell when, oh my gosh, what, Grey's Anatomy? How many things did they get wrong?
don't
get you started.
Grey's is great for entertainment. I do not take them seriously. I don't think they represent a medical situation. I just think as entertainment, fantastic. But to be honest though, I know it sounds weird, but some of the real life happenings in hospitals is actually a lot more bizarre than Grey's Anatomy sometimes.
Very, very true. My sister was in nursing school, and she, you know, works in a hospital, and she'll sometimes describe to me situations that I've never seen on, you know, any sort of show. So I would absolutely agree with that. It seems like, you know, in some areas they tone it down, in others they make it extremely bizarre. Of course, the romance side, right? It has to be way up there, all of the, you know, colleague romance. But, you know, they seem to tone down some of the medical happenings.
Of course, I mean, because think about it. If they actually showed what truly happens in hospitals, it's boring, to be honest. You know, working, it really is. It's routine. It's very routine. It's boring. So you need to amp up the drama factor. And also, some of the diseases or illnesses only occur once in a medical lifetime. So you probably might just see it once or twice in your medical career. Certainly not every week, like Grey's Anatomy does.
But you have to have drama in there somewhere. So this is fascinating to me. So boarding school, you were in Nigeria, you had that crazy experience as a child, and then you've been a microbiologist, you've been a headhunter. I'm sure we could spend hours talking about all that in between, but now you have written a book. So not only do you just appreciate books and great fiction and all of this, but now you've written a book and you have this fantastic business that I don't even know we have gotten ever spoken about, how you even got into the world of luxury and, you know, won all of these baking competitions and your cake emporium. And so what made you, like, what got you into the cake business in the first place, and why did you love it so much?
That's another thing. Let's go back to my childhood. I started baking when I was about 10, 11, after I came back from boarding school, went to a day school, and my friend at the time gave me a book. It was a baking book. And I couldn't believe that simple ingredients would combine to make a cake. And being the curious child that I was, I took some of my mother's old pots, because you need to understand, in those days, I'm showing my age now, in an African household, you really did not have cake tins. So I kind of took some of her old pots that she was about to throw away because they were old and damaged. I would take them, hide them under my bed, and I would use those to bake. And then I noticed that some of the pots, some would bake the cake on the outside, but the inside would still be raw. Some burnt the cakes, and some were quite good. So that was what happened.
So what did those cake, not the tins, but what do you even call them, and what did they look like?
Oh, just normal, like a Victoria sponge, like a pound cake. A chocolate cake. I mean, just normal cake. I just bake a normal cake because I was using a recipe book. And I started baking for friends. Then I would bake for my friends' mothers. And then after a while, I just kind of stopped so I could focus on my studies. And I kind of like left it. But over the years, intermittently, I would bake. And then I got to a milestone birthday when I was a headhunter, and I kind of thought, if I don't do it now, I'll never do it. And that was what made me start my cake business. I was practically middle-aged when I started my cake business.
I was just thinking,
if I made enough to live on, that'd be great. But I didn't expect my life to take the turn that it did. I've had loads of adventures. I've met incredible, incredible people. I've baked, for royalty, millionaires, billionaires. I've baked on yachts. I've traveled the world. I've been flown out to countries I can't even pronounce the name properly. And it's just been an adventure. But unfortunately, COVID hit and boom. That was why I went off to Clubhouse, as it were.
How interesting. Okay, so I want to back up before we get into like what's going on now. But like, what was your first big break or big moment when you realized this whole cake thing could go from just being, a hobby or something I could maybe put, meet ends with, to this incredible thing where you've got, you've been on competitions and you judge competitions and all, like, what was that big break?
My big break was actually, honestly, I tell the story and I still have goosebumps. In those days, there were no online directories because the internet was very much in its infancy. So I then did what I was trained to do as a headhunter. I picked up the phone book called the Yellow Pages and I started calling party planners and wedding planners. And I'll never forget, I think day three, after I called about 100 people, a very young voice at the end of the phone said, "Do you make cupcakes?" And I said, "Of course I do." And she said, "That's great, because we've been looking for someone to make cupcakes." And I said, "Sure, I'm going to be in your area in the next 3 days or so, and I'm happy to drop you some samples. So took the samples into the company, and then I just left because I dropped them, left my card, and I left. By the time I got back home, I got a phone call from a Lady Elizabeth Anson, who is proper royalty, and she said, love the cakes, tasted delicious. I'd like to order 250 or thereabouts. This is the thing. Lady Elizabeth Anson is cousin to Queen Elizabeth.
Wow. Wow.
And one of the few people that literally hugs the Queen. Lady Elizabeth is dead now. God rest her soul. I think she died last year or the year before. And she was an incredible person. She taught me so much about dealing with people in that sort of sphere.
So you were able to stay in touch after this first order?
Absolutely. We're talking about 2000 and possibly 2008 or 7. And yeah, we did. And I did work for her a number of times. And I made the cupcakes. I was one of three cake makers that she engaged for this particular party. It was a massive party. And she did a couple of things which I will never, ever forget. And I will always, always thank her. And if I see any of her children or grandchildren, I will forever say thank you. She wrote a handwritten letter to thank me, to say my cakes were the best tasting, delicious, etc. So she sent me the note. And she also said that if I want to, I can actually use that note as a testimonial for my marketing. She didn't have to do that, but she did that.
That's incredible.
I know. That was one of the kindest things. And bear in mind that the other 98 people that I had called prior to her, it was a very firm no or a rude no. I had a couple of meetings, and some of the meetings, I wouldn't say I cried, but they were hurtful. Let's put it that way. Even if you say no, you don't have to say no in a hurtful way. And yet, this is someone who was actually the first professional party planner in the UK, the creme de la creme. She does all the Queen's parties. And yet, she not only did she say yes, she literally threw open the door to me. So it just goes to show, you've got to keep going. Even if you keep hearing the word no, just keep going until you hear yes.
What I love so much about that experience that you had is from the very first moment that we started talking, I could hear the passion in your voice to help someone like me who was at my beginning at the time that we first met. And I love just hearing stories where, you know, I talk all the time about how my generation of native digitals, how we think differently and how we, you know, we've grown up in a different world. And then the folks who grew up in the native analog generation who weren't fully integrated with machines, how their world and their life was different. But the common thread is we all have that human experience of knowing what it's like to fail or to be rejected or to hear the word no and feeling so disappointed in what we choose to do with that, or the people who give us the first yes, they are often the ones who leave the biggest impact on our life and our career. So I want to say, you know, back to you, thank you for doing that for me last year.
Oh gosh, it's the least I can do, because I promise you, I have been on the receiving end of the most incredible kindness. And I've also been on the receiving end of the most incredible unkindness. So I know what it feels like. I know what both extremes feel like. And as a human being, if there is any remote chance that you can help someone, why wouldn't you? It doesn't make sense to me. Me not helping you doesn't make my life better.
Absolutely.
So if I can make your life better and richer, why not? I still don't understand. I still don't get it when people behave in a certain way. I just can't get my head around that. But I'm just thankful anyway that somehow karma or whatever you call it, you know, whatever you sow, you reap kind of situation. I believe in the law of reciprocity. I believe in giving good out there. So whatever I can do to help, I would gladly do.
Well, absolutely. And what Lady Elizabeth did for you is just such a powerful testament to that first yes means so much. And now, you know, looking at what you're able to do now, like tell me about that shift. What's been going on this past year since COVID? I know you and and Simba have launched a podcast, and I've loved listening to the episodes. In fact, I loved that wrap up of 2021 of the best things that happened. I actually hadn't heard about the Tiffany story about how they did that April Fool's joke.
Right. This is exactly why we started the Luxury News Weekly podcast, because we kind of felt that there were certain stories in the luxury sector that weren't being told. And we could, you know, the funny thing was, it was actually Simba's idea, because he was looking for stories on luxury and he couldn't find any. Yes, there are some sites where, yes, they talk about luxury, but it was mainly fashion, or it was mainly, but we wanted a nice mix of business and human interest and fun. And we kind of like got together on Clubhouse, and we did it solidly every week for 6 months. And it was only in the last couple of months that I said to him, we can't record anything on Clubhouse. Why not take it onto a podcast? And that was how we started. So the Tiffany story about the April Fools, that for us was a hoot, because they even went one step further and painted one of their stores yellow. They literally, so to me, it was one of the best luxury stories of 2021.
So remind me exactly what they did. They essentially, is it that they announced on April Fool's Day that they were changing or getting rid of Tiffany blue completely and changing it to Tiffany yellow?
That's correct. So they announced, you know, this is our new color, Tiffany yellow. Now, usually on a good day, they get 100 comments, maybe 200, if what they post is particularly engaging. They had 10,500 comments on their Instagram post saying, this is a monumental mistake, this shouldn't happen, blah, 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 blah. Because they thought it through, they created a hashtag, they painted one of their stores, they went for the branding. Everything looked so real and so true. So it took a while. And then eventually some people said, hang on, look at the date. Even Tiffany themselves were saying, guys, look at the date. And then the penny dropped. So yes, it was a hoot. I loved it.
Well, and speaking of ways like that to connect with a younger audience, or at least build up social media hype and all of that, I mean, it reminds me a lot of what other brands are not able to do as well, or haven't figured out a way of doing, you know, and actually being able to resonate with an audience that is on Instagram, for example. So I'm really curious to pick your brain on some of the best or worst, we could go there too, examples of what you've seen in the luxury space that you think are great examples of companies really being able to connect with native digitals that are, you know, that are not falling behind the curve. And as I shared before we even pressed play on this recording, these companies who are kind of dead men walking and they don't realize they've already died. What are some like best and worst examples that you've seen lately of companies in the luxury space that are pushing forward and actually able to resonate with the next generation?
An example that comes to mind straight away is the collaboration between Gucci and Balenciaga. So I call it the Gucciaga collaboration. Both are great companies. Both are incredible at marketing to Gen Zs and millennials, hands down. Now, a lot of luxury purists would say, well, they're not really luxury companies. They're more premium. That's great. That's all splitting hairs. But guess what? They have smartly realized that by initially introducing a younger audience to certain things first, they can then upsell onto the couture lines onto the real luxury stuff. I think with Gucci and Balenciaga, they've got creative directors who are quite cool, who know how to create hype, who know how to market. Balenciaga, personally, is not one of my favorite brands because they do, in terms of design, if I'm being a purist here, there are certain things they do design-wise that doesn't sit right with me. Certain basic things that they do and they try to sell as luxury, which I don't think is. They've also done a few things that I think were not right in terms of cultural appropriation. So they've done a few not that great things, Balenciaga, but when they did the collaboration with Gucci, they created some really incredible pieces. The marketing around it was good, and it showed that, yes, you can be competitors in the same space, but you can create something called co-opetition, which really appeals to Gen Zs and millennials, in my opinion, because when you're talking about values, you know, you're talking about kindness, you're talking about sustainability, etc., etc. There are ways in which you can bring the younger generation into that without it necessarily be all about, and again, oh, this is awful. I'm going to use, just like I said that Tiffany did that amazing, incredible stunt, they also did something which didn't really sit well with us as well. So they were mentioned in the best luxury news, and they were also mentioned in the worst luxury news. So in the worst luxury news, they did a campaign with Jay-Z and Beyonce, which was great. So nothing wrong with using Jay-Z and Beyonce. However, they used a particular diamond that was a blood diamond. I would have loved to see something, especially nowadays, if they're talking about values and sustainability, etc., etc., I would have loved to see maybe a lab-grown diamond, maybe a replica of that particular diamond, or maybe something created specially for Jay-Z and Beyoncé. They did, however, pledge to donate to certain colleges, etc., in America, which is great. But that campaign wasn't well thought out.
Mm. Oh, so, I hear that.
Yeah. So it wasn't well thought out, because if you're talking about blood diamonds, it really resonates deeply with certain people, with a number of people, and with a generation that has gone back through time to research the past. Because that's another thing I've noticed about Gen Zs and millennials. Their research capabilities is amazing. They will find the dirt that you're trying to hide. So you need to be very transparent, and you need to be able to hold yourself accountable. And Tiffany did not do that, unfortunately, on that particular campaign. But everything else, I love them for.
100%. I mean, authenticity and transparency, if I could pick a top thing Gen Z is looking for, whether as an employee or a consumer, those are 100% at the top. And you're so right. Just the capability of Gen Z to know how to research, and even the, you know, the visuals that we see, or the way leader positions are structured, leadership in a company or the board of directors, we are quick to call out any bullshit that occurs, you know, within a company. And so I would completely agree that some of these brands who are not realizing the impact of their actions before launching a campaign, or how that's going to resonate with the next generation, are certainly making some slip-ups. But, you know, I love that example of what Gucci and Balenciaga are doing, because I remember watching their collaboration and thinking, well, this is fascinating to see younger models, for example. I mean, they looked, some of the people modeling their recent collection looked like they were in their, you know, late teens or early 20s, as opposed to the typical models we see on the runway who, you know, have a certain look, and they're, you know, super slim, as we all know, and they're, you know, look like they're in their late 20s. So it seems like they're doing a great job of connecting with my generation from a lot of different standpoints. points, not just the collection, but how they're choosing to collaborate and how they're choosing to work with other companies.
Oh, absolutely. And also, they have been very active in the technology and NFT space. And NFTs, again, for lack of a better word, it's more of a younger person's kind of thing. They've used the creation of NFTs, the creation of certain digital products that they've actually collaborated with a number of gaming companies. And they sell those items for, I don't know, $5, $10, $20, something like that. Yes, I know it's, again, about sales. But the fact that they're thinking ahead in terms of getting into technology, getting into the gaming space, etc., again, I commend them for that because it's good marketing. Some of it doesn't sit well with me, but some of it's, you know, I cannot fault them for being good business people. I also love the fact that they've chosen to mark 100 years of Gucci by doing a series of things like creating these gardens, doing a real garden as well as a virtual garden, doing a museum, again, real museum and virtual museum. So they've really thought out the technology piece.
I know we could talk about this for hours. And also, I know I saw an article recently that you just made NFT history as well by being, what was it, the first person or first luxury cake designer, is it, to launch an NFT in that sphere?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, for me, again, I'm curious. I'm very nosy. And I just wanted to know what the hype was all about. And I thought if I was going to do an NFT, I might as well put lots of zeros on it. I literally just chose my lucky number, which was 5. So I just created an NFT. It's very dynamic. But with this particular NFT, I've actually created a contract where you get a real cake. So it's not just a virtual cake. I will fly out anywhere in the world and you will get a real cake, a replica of the cake that I created, either for your wedding or for a special occasion, etc., etc. So I've included quite a bit into that particular contract on that particular blockchain. So for me, it was the best way to learn is to do. So I thought, well, if you can't beat them, join them. So why not create an NFT? And I didn't realize at the time that I was the first luxury cake maker to do so.
That is incredible. And it just goes to show that, you know, we can have these conversations about native digitals and native analogs, but what you're doing is taking your business model that has been successful in the real world and saying, you know, how can we move this into the virtual space and also attach value to it, which is what I love, you know, me as a native digital, watching what's happening with NFTs. It kind of reminds me of, you know, what was it called? The tulip situation back in the early 2000s, or, you know, any of these big hypes that occur around something that inherently doesn't hold a lot of value. But when you connect it with that experience in person or the, you know, the ability to, like you said, and I would love to hear how you're doing that, by the way, just with taking, you know, the physical experience of a cake for your wedding or your anniversary and being able to purchase that through the blockchain and have those experiences for years. That's brilliant. Honestly, it's brilliant.
Absolutely. And I love that you've referenced Tulip Fever. Because yes. In those days, or, you know, Tulip Fever or Tulip Mania, because in those days, people actually paid up to the equivalent of £300,000 for a single bulb of tulip. Would you believe that? And
it's
you're
insane.
Absolutely right. I know, right? And to think that you can pick up a bunch of tulips now for a few pounds. So again, I know I created my NFT months ago. Believe it or not, that technology is now updated, is now slightly obsolete. It's not the same anymore. Things have changed so rapidly in the NFT space. And that's what you have. You have this early adopter syndrome. So you have people that go into it. It's almost, I wouldn't say it's a pyramid scheme, but I would say the people that get in early and are very savvy and do their marketing and are very commercially aware, they make the most money. So you've got your people like somebody like Beeple. I think he's called Beeple.
Mm-hmm.
And he created this video. He made about $6 million or pounds. He created another one, make millions. And there are people who make millions. But the vast majority of people at the bottom of the pyramid will not make anything, because it's like any other business. You've got to get the marketing right. You've got to get the buyers. You've got to get the followers. You've got to get your vehicle. You've got to build a hype around yourself. So again, am I going to be able to sell my $1 million NFT? Probably not. But for me, it was the process of creating one. But for me, it wasn't about making the money. I'd love to, if anyone's listening, and we're going to put it out there. But more importantly, it's about the process. And it's not about whether you can make a fast buck or not.
Exactly. Exactly. I love that. And it's such a good way to wrap up this conversation. I would love to have another conversation with you and just learn how, you know, what that process was, because I feel like more and more companies I speak with who are wondering, you know, do we get into that space, or, you know, what is the future of it going to look like? That is truly a, you know, thing that's at top of mind, along with, you know, how do I retain staff? It's NFTs and staff. But anyway, Elizabeth, I know you've got to go. I have so enjoyed this conversation. I really would love to have you back, because every time we talk, I feel like my brain is expanded to just thinking about life in a different way. And I just love that about you. So thank you so much for having this conversation. It's been a blast.
Absolutely. Anytime. I always love chatting with you. Time just seems to fly. And yes, I am looking forward to many other collaborations that we are definitely going to have in the future. And thank you so much for having me on today.
Absolutely. Go women in business.
Yay.
Thanks for listening to the Native Digital, Native Analog Show. If you enjoyed this episode, I'd really appreciate it if you would subscribe, leave a rating and review, and tell your friends. If you're looking to connect and talk more about attracting and retaining native digitals, you can reach me at hannahgwilliams.com. Thanks again, and I'll see you next time.